Hello everyone, and welcome to a special guest episode of the History of England, all about rights of way and commons. This is a bit of an indulgence, I have to be honest with you. It is about history to a large extent. How is it that England and Wales come to have an extensive network of rights of way crossing over private land? What lies behind the practice, strange to modern ears, of private property over which nonetheless the public have rights? On the other hand, it's a bit of an indulgence because, frankly, it's also about promoting the need for greater access to the countryside and for preserving those rights that exist now. So, you will hear an interview between me and Kate Ashbrook from one of the oldest of institutions formed to protect those rights, the Open Spaces Society. Before I let you loose, there are a couple of things I wanted to say up front. Passionate though I am about the value of public access rights to our countryside, and passionate as I am to see those common rights extended, I very much accept that landowners, particularly farmers, face a lot of challenges. My argument is that greater access will also embed a sense of partnership between landowner and visitor, much less of the them and us mentality, and greater respect for the countryside, which will lead us to treat it better. But it is important to emphasise, without wanting to get too preachy, that it is a two-way thing. If landowners must give greater access, so must the rest of us treat it with respect. Now, there is a newly revised countryside code I'm sure you'll all be excited to learn, and I urge you all to read it. You can download it from the History of England website on the post for this episode. Finally then, if you would like to know more about the work of the Open Spaces Society and support their work, please go to their website, www.oss.org.uk. There's loads of information, actually, about access rights within that website, and there's a link to it from my website. So, onward. Hello, everyone. Today, we've got a chance to talk about a subject dear to my heart, the way that attitudes to property and access to the countryside have worked and changed over time, and the impact that that's left on England's environment, particularly with regards to footpaths and rights of way, on which I spend an unfeasible percentage of my time. I have a very special guest to help me here, Kate Ashbrook. Kate, introduce yourself.
Hello. Yes, Kate Ashbrook, General Secretary of the Open Spaces Society, which is Britain's oldest national conservation body.
And we'll talk a bit more about the history of the Society and its foundation and so on later. But could you start by just giving me an overview? What is the Open Space Society? What is it for?
OK, well, the headline is that we campaign for people's rights to enjoy open spaces and public paths throughout England and Wales and in town and country.
Excellent. So footpaths and other rights of way then, very important to the way we access the countryside. Where do they come from?
Well, public paths go right back through history. I mean, one can say that the history of our landscape is written in our path network because they show how people used to travel, whether on foot or horseback, from A to B. And it might be a very long distance trade route like a salt way, or it might be a local path from the church to the to somebody's house, or from somebody's house to the school, or to where they worked at the farm. So you have this network of paths in a community which may show how people used to travel.
Yes, it's fascinating. I think around us we have a lot of them, and I think when you follow them through you can see connecting farms and very dispersed settlement we have around here, and there's an old Roman embankment actually near us where you can see a path that goes specifically to it. And some of these are very ancient, aren't they?
Oh, yes. And they go back, when you think of the Ridgeway, mm-hmm. the McNeild Way,
right
across England, certainly do. And so, and Offa's Dyke path, well, it follows Offa's Dyke, but I'm sure people walked along Offa's Dyke. So, yeah, we're talking about prehistoric times.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that really excites me is that when you're walking on the Ridgeway or the McNeild Way, you are walking in the footsteps literally of countless, countless generations.
Absolutely. And I mean, I live in the village of Tourville in mm-hmm. Buckinghamshire, and there's an old road that goes down into the village, very sunken. And I like to think, you know, that's that's kind of been worn away by the feet of and carriage wheels of centuries.
I think I know the one you're talking about, actually. The Holloways are absolutely wonderful, aren't they? I don't quite know why they're so exciting, but they are brilliant. They're just record of our history.
Real sense of history, yeah.
OK, so are there different types of rights of way? Or is there just one? Or, and if so, if there are different types, where do they come from and how are they different?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to remember that all these routes are highways in law, so that footpaths, bridleways, etc. are highways just like any road, and which is interesting because then they have the same laws. I've just now mentioned footpaths, bridleways, so there we start with a difference. First of all, I should say that the public rights of way were recorded on an official map for the first time in 1949 National Parks and Access to the Countryside Act introduced the definitive map, and then you had to claim the routes. So anything that's on that map is a highway, but if it's not on the map, it could still be a highway. And so that definitive map records footpaths, bridleways, restricted byways, byways open to all traffic. And that's an indication of the different types of usage. So the rights right. on a footpath are only by foot, and the rights on a bridleway are horse riders, cyclists, who must give way to other users. On a restricted byway, you bring in carriage drivers as well. Mm. So there are slightly different rules relating to each of them, but basically they are all highways. You can't stop them up. We have the right to pass and repass along them. And if they were highways historically, even if they're not visible on the ground, if they were not officially stopped up in law, they're still highways. Mm. You can still claim that route.
So that's very interesting that they've survived for this long. And you're saying 1949 was a key date. Up until that point, have we lost paths? Have they disappeared? Have they been expunged? How have we managed to get to this point where we still have so many of them?
Well, we've lost a huge amount.
Right.
So we still have many, but there are probably as many that we do not have because they've just got forgotten about and built over or mistreated in some way. 1949 certainly was kind of watershed point. Our ancestors went out and got them recorded and got them put on the map. But there are a great many that haven't yet been recorded.
Right. One of my experiences has been my mother lives in Rutland, which is very open countryside, very unlike here, and there are far fewer paths. Does topography or geography or that sort of thing make a difference to survival?
Yes, I'm sure it does. And the east of England, and the East Midlands, or Rutlands in the East Midlands, do have fewer paths. I mean, it's a great generalisation, and I think that's really to do with the Enclosure Act, which also affects commons. The Enclosure Act took away the paths, or might well have done, and if they were not kind of saved in that process, then they disappeared. Mm. And there were early and big enclosures in the east of England, in particular, area.
Certainly. I think there was a lot of parliamentary enclosure in that area.
Yes.
The other thing I was learning about Henry Repton's red books. Henry Repton, of course, as you probably know better than me, a guy who designed these lovely parklands and big estates that we have, like Capability Brown, for example. And in that, there's probably a process of exclusion there as well, isn't there, where people built these big estates and didn't want people walking across the front of them anymore.
Yeah, well, and then they moved the village so they couldn't see it.
Absolutely.
Basically. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of brutal, you know.
Yeah.
John Clare obviously wrote about it a lot. Absolutely brutal the way that people were treated and their rights just completely trampled on, ignored, expunged. Yeah.
Yes, I love the poetry of John Clare, actually. Yes. He's a very immediate insight into an ordinary person's view of what enclosure was like, what the impact was on a village.
Yes,
it's absolutely an amazing record, isn't it?
Yes.
So in actual fact, in many cases, when we look at these lovely parklands, Chatsworth, whatever, which are very beautiful, actually, there's a lot of history and a lot of pain that went into some of those, which is, I don't know, not a good thing to remember maybe, but it's important, I think, as to how important what the work you do is.
And when you look at those parks, there's probably no legal access. You know, the rights of way are not there. The park, the estate owner might make permissive paths because that's kind of easy for them. They can come and go, those permissive paths, and suit the landowner's whim. But you probably find that an awful lot of the rights of way have disappeared and you only can get there by paying, basically.
So the history is in a way one of conflict. What's the Open Space Society's history and part in that, and indeed outside the OSS, what are the big events that led us to try and protect these rights of way?
Well, I think the founding of the Society is a pretty big event.
Yeah.
Although I can't say that it happened because of something very definite, but in the mid... Well, in the 1860s, the commons in and around London were threatened with enclosure and gravel extraction. And so the society was formed in order to fight those. Mm. And there was a Metropolitan Commons Act going through, which the society was very much involved in, which gave some protection to London Commons. So we claim credit for saving Hampstead Heath, Epping right. Forest, Wimbledon Common. You know, they trip off my tongue.
Yeah.
Just like that. But of course, it was absolutely huge, huge, huge battles.
Yeah.
And a lot of legal work. And one of our lawyers was Robert Hunter, who was much more famous for founding the National Trust. But we had him first. He was ours. And a brilliant chap. And so that was how the society formed. So I think that period is really interesting because, like the 1860s, we're just at the end of the enclosure movement. But we're at the start of industrialisation, railways, transport, and also people getting out into the open spaces more. So you've got kind of a whole lot of things coming together. It's not so much to do with agriculture and enclosure, it's more to do with development, but also people's greater awareness. So those two things coming together, I think were a bit of a catalyst, really. So that's a big moment. Another big moment, I suppose, was when we formed, I suppose I have to admit that we formed the National Trust instead of becoming that landowning body ourselves.
Right.
Robert Hunter, Octavia Hill and others thought, you know, we need to have a landowning body in order to be effective in saving commons. And so they formed the National Trust. But the society did a great deal of raising money to save commons and then give them to the National Trust. So an awful lot of commons in Kent and Surrey actually came about, their saving came about through the society. So that was important. I think our history is quite marked with legislation.
Right.
So Law of Property Acts in 1925, which actually made it more difficult to enclose a common, for instance, and also gave new public rights to commons, recognised rights to walk on certain commons. So that was important. We come on to the 1949 Act, which I mentioned, about national parks and areas of outstanding natural beauty, but more important because of the official map. But that came after the Kinderscout trespass in 1932, for which I can claim no credit for the society at all. And it is interesting. I mean, people kind of write about that. We've got the 90th anniversary this year, so that's it's an important point. And people say, oh, you know, the Ramblers and open spaces were right in there. We were not. We were saying this is going to set back the cause of access.
Right.
You know, and we did not recognise that that direct action actually did make a difference.
Right.
Five people sent to jail quite wrongly, and then a mood among the public that this is grossly unfair and these landowners and gamekeepers have behaved incredibly badly. And so gradually that moved towards getting greater access.
Yeah.
Which we got some in the National Parks Act. Then, you know, it's moving on. Commons had to be registered in 1965. You know, that's another
Can I stop you there just for a moment and ask you about commons? Because you've mentioned commons.
Yeah,
I haven't really explained what they are, actually.
Them.
So what is a commons?
Commons now are land over which other people have rights. But we're not talking about rights of access particularly. We're talking about private rights or rights of particular properties to graze animals, collect wood, collect bracken, but all for the purposes of their property. So, you know, there were the days when collecting bracken to make your roof or feed your, or give animals bedding, you know, all these things, or wood for the fire, or animals to graze the common so that you could eat them or get the wool off the sheep or whatever. All that is to do with your personal economy, the personal economy, not anything commercial, and it's not to be commercial. It's all to do with the survival. And so this all comes, you know, goes back to the enclosures. When land was enclosed, other land was meant to be left for the peasants, basically, but it wasn't, you know, and you mentioned John Clare, you know, we know it wasn't. It should have been. So an awful lot of land went. But some commons survived, and probably more in the north and west. There's certainly bigger commons. I mean, the northern commons are very big. But there are commons in every county in England and Wales. Every county will have a bit of common land. It's the land that survived.
Yeah.
And my society knew about these commons back in the 1860s, and we were campaigning for them, but they were not recorded on a register.
Right.
You know, there was nowhere where you could look it up. And it wasn't until 1965 Commons Registration Act that the registers were created. And we had 3 years in which to register commons. So we went rushing around the country. And the thing is that you only had 3 years. So we just put in for everything we could. slightly regardless. I mean, everybody did, yeah, because we had such a short time. And if you didn't register it, then you lost it altogether. So we'd put in some that probably weren't suitable, and then there was a process for determining it. But actually, if there was no objection to that, it just went on the register. So there are some on the register that probably shouldn't be.
So that the message generally is constant vigilance, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
You've really got to really watch these at every moment and fight for them to protect them.
You should also say, what protection do they have? And that's a really good question, because they don't have as much as they should. I mentioned the Law of Property Act. I mean, it's all, you know, history is written in these Acts of Parliament. But Law of Property Act 1925 did actually establish broadly for commons that you can't kind of put things up there without getting consent from, in effect, the government. And that still exists. That provision still exists. It's changed through time. But so if you want to put a fence around the common, you have to get the consent of the Department for Environment. But the problem is, if you put up the fence without getting consent, nobody has a legal duty to do anything about it.
Right.
So they're not as well protected as they should be, basically. Right. And there's all sorts of loopholes in the law.
It relies on people to challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to. And you need to challenge early on. You can't leave it for 5 years and then challenge it, because the law doesn't really look kindly on people who hang around. You know, you've got to get on with it. I mean, all sorts of people have powers to do things, and local authorities do, but of course local authorities have no money. The public does, and we haven't yet, I think, really tested that.
Right.
That came in more recently, and we need to test it. So, you know, if somebody's got a really good example of an unlawful work on a registered common, we would help them contest it.
Right. I understand also there's a particularly important act that happened relatively recently, within the last 20 years. Do you want to tell me more about that and what difference has that made?
That's the Commons Act 2006. So that was the first kind of comprehensive commons legislation for 50 years or so. One aspect of it which is important is that it reopened the registers. You know, I said that we only had 3 years for registration back at the end of the 60s, 70s, which was nothing like enough. And we've always wanted to have a chance to rescue those lost commons. And there were a number at the time of the previous registration that didn't get put on the register because there were various court cases sort of happening about registration at the same time. And one court case went the wrong way and sort of prevented a whole lot of registrations. It then got overturned. But by the time it was overturned, it was too late to kind of revive those cases. So this act it's rather kind of grudging from the government, quite honestly, because it says in certain counties you can re-register. You can re-register common land, you can re-register lost commons on certain fairly limited grounds. But there were only, in the original, seven areas where it could happen. And again, it was a very short time, and that period has ended December before last. So now we're left in England with North Yorkshire and Cumbria, where we can re-register lost commons, and then there's the whole of Wales. We've got till 2027 for England, 2032 for Wales. So the Society's got a special project with a project officer, Francis Kerner, who's a historian, who is researching all this and putting in applications.
Right.
And mostly what we're putting in, you know, they are small areas, but they are important. And if we get them on the register in due course, then the public will have the right to walk there, maybe to ride if it's a certain type of common, and it will be, you know, have a certain amount of protection. So it is a very worthwhile project, but we're pretty fed up that the government has been unfair, because it's also said that landowners can apply to take land off throughout England, not just the seven counties and the two counties, but throughout. So, you know, it's blatantly unfair.
Yeah, unfair. And there's a project also about lost pathways, isn't there? Or is that the same project?
Oh, that's quite different. No,
yes.
And we're not leading on that. The Ramblers have a Don't Lose Your Way project.
Yes.
And this is because in 2000, the government introduced legislation which says on the 1st of January 2026, it will no longer be possible to claim paths for the map. Now, I mentioned earlier that you can claim a path, you know, through, if once a highway, always a highway. So if you've got the historic evidence that it was marked as a path on an enclosure award or a tithe map, you can claim it for the official map, even though it's not there. And you can do that any time. And you've always been able, for some years, you've been able to do that at any time. But now they're saying you've got to do it by the 1st of January 2026. And it may even apply to paths which we're using today. The law isn't yet clear.
Yes.
Well, you know, 2026, that date is now less than 4 years away.
Right.
So the Ramblers are, with the British Horse Society as well, they are spearheading a project to get paths on the map. It's well worth looking at their websites to see how they're doing it, because anyone can take part. And I'm sure your listeners would find it of interest.
Yeah. I've joined up, so I'm going to try and do my bit for it. But so, yes, it's very easy to join up, and there's a bag of information there available. Yeah. So, yeah, I recommend it too. Okay, how similar is England and the UK to other parts of the world in terms of its rights of way and common rights?
You started by saying England and the UK, so we have to break that down.
Yes.
England and Wales at the moment are very similar. Things could go differently because Wales obviously can make its own legislation. It's looking at access legislation, but I think it's with commons legislation, probably it's not going to look at particularly. Scotland is different already. It has the Land Reform Act 2003, so people have the right to walk, ride, cycle, swim, you know, all sorts of activities, kind of anywhere with the exceptions listed. But that doesn't mean it's physically available. It just means that you have the right, but you don't have the right to break down a fence in order to get onto a piece of land. So that's quite frustrating, I think. And Scotland is actually wanting to have paths as well, or Scottish Ramblers, Scottish Act user groups. So they're now looking at how they can get paths protected. Other nations, really, they don't have a rights of way system like we have. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm sure we've all followed trails in the USA and in France, but it's not the same as our system, where the actual path, the highway, is public land. It belongs to the public, you know, that now the highway authority over someone else's land. It's probably would have had to have been bought if it was going to be that, you know, like some of the trails in the US. So nobody really has our wonderful path network. Commons are really interesting, and I do go to international conferences, and the concept of commons at these academic conferences is kind of shared whatever. It's not just land, it might be air, it might be the internet. But you talk about the actual lands, and they're not a bit like us, not registered, and it's not coming, you know, from a manorial system or a feudal system or any of that. But there is a concept of land where certain people have rights. And in India, for instance, you know, I've talked about commons in India to Indian people, you know, and we've swapped information. And there are similar kind of themes. Philosophically, it's kind of similar. So it's a fascinating subject, actually.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. And on a personal note, you must spend a lot of time on commons and footpaths and talking to people about this. Give me a couple of your favourites or one of your favourites.
Oh, well, I'm very, very fond of Dartmoor, which is where I sort of my campaigning career started on Dartmoor. And Dartmoor is one big common, really. But I am fortunate enough to own a small piece of common land on Dartmoor, a very steep, rocky slope with trees at the bottom and the river Tavy at the very bottom, and the upper slope, which I try to manage for butterflies, with beautiful views and just a lovely place where you can wander and get lost in yourself, really. It's just, I love it. I'm fortunate to live in the Chilterns, and here the commons are very different. You know, that's what's so interesting about the England and Wales is that every part of them have different landscapes and different sorts of commons. So the Chiltern Commons, you've got some of these ridgetop commons like Maidensgrove, Russell's Water, where you've just got a huge open space and it's just wonderful. But you've also got the little places with the little woody places. So I live in Turville, as I've said, and we've got four commons in Turville. And they're all, you know, really, they're kind of what's left after the enclosure. But we've got Turville Heath Common, South End Common, Summer Heath and North End. And they're all, you know, little wooded commons with little open spaces and glades. And they're absolutely gorgeous. The problem is, though, with so many of these commons, that they're not being used in the traditional way. So they're not being grazed.
Right.
All these commons, you know, were grazed, whether it was sheep, cattle, pigs, goats, whatever. And that doesn't happen now because lifestyles have changed. And the people who've got rights, even if they've registered them, are not exercising them because they're going off, you know, they're commuters or they're second homers or all that. So, you know, and also there are busy roads, so you don't want to risk your animals getting killed, and you don't want to get into the thing about fencing and all that. So unfortunately, it's commons are changing. They're getting scrubbed over. So then one kind of, you know, thinks, well, one maybe should be pleased about that and think about rewilding. But, you know, there's so many issues about the management of commons.
Well, interestingly, one of the places that I loved going to was Selborne in Hampshire. There's a lovely common there at the top of a hill, and what they're doing is using old techniques of managing it. So they're grazing it, they've got some cows there, they're cutting the wood back for undercroft. And not only is it a lovely environment where you can go and you can walk, but it's also a way of seeing how we used to manage the land. And where that happens, that's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, that
is wonderful. A magical area. It's absolutely fantastic. Okay, fantastic. So what's next for the OSS?
Well, we are trying to protect urban open spaces, particularly. I mean, right now, you know, this week, as we speak, we've had the levelling up proposals, and we're saying yes, but if you're going to level up, you've got to level up people's opportunity for green spaces, because they are so important. The pandemic has shown even more how important they are, and yet there's not a lot in there about how we're going to create green spaces in towns close to where people live so they don't have to battle with traffic and danger and pollution in order to enjoy a good quality space. So we're working away on that. And one of the things we encourage people to do is to try to register land as village greens. And village greens, the traditional village green, you know, you think of the maple and the, you know, the spreading chestnut tree, and, you know, you're sitting in the pub, you know, on the grass, and it's all, somebody's playing cricket and all that.
You can make me start crying in a minute.
Yeah, well, I know. Yes, yes. So that's the traditional village green, and we got lots of them. They had to be registered the same time as commons, and there are lots, and they vary, of course. But actually, the definition of village green is any land that local people have used for 20 years for some kind of informal recreation without being stopped, without asking permission. Mm. So provided no signs up and nobody's actually stopped you doing it and you've done it, you can register it. The registration process is fairly involved and lengthy. You get witness statements and you put it into your county or unitary council. But once the land is registered, it is protected from development. Right. And it is a strong protection. It's Victorian legislation and old words, but they still hold good. And local people have rights there, the right of sports and pastimes that they've got. So we say to people, think about that. In 2013, the government brought in a rather nasty act, Growth and Infrastructure Act, which actually stopped people from being able to do that if the land was threatened with planning permission. So the big message is, think about open spaces, little bits of land in your community that you've enjoyed before it's threatened.
Right.
Before it gets into the local plan for development or the neighbourhood plan. And it doesn't have to be the traditional space. So it can be that scruffy bit of land, you know, near the housing estate or behind the factory or whatever. If you've used it for that period and you've got evidence that people have, then try to register it. That's one thing. The other thing is that can also be done voluntarily by a beneficent landowner without any of the evidence of use. So we're saying to local councils who own land, you know, come on, just register it and then it's protected, you know. So why would you not want to do that, I think?
Right.
And locally to us, David, here in Henley, you know, there are two pieces of land registered as village greens by Henley Town Council. There's Gillett's Field and there's also Freeman's Meadow just here.
Right.
So, you know, they've done it. A really good example. It's also happened in the north in Scorton. We've got a few examples, but not enough. So those are things that people can do. Really important. And the other thing in England is that there is a new kind of planning designation of local green space, which you should try to get into your neighbourhood or local plan, again, giving some protection. But legislation for open spaces has always been weak and not very helpful. So what's next for us is to try and strengthen all that and to get people using it and really aware of what they can do.
So if people want to do something practical, they don't quite know what to do, they come to you?
They do. They can look at our website, which has got loads of information. But yes, they certainly come to us. We will ask them to join because we are a small charity that needs support.
Well, it's cheap as chips.
And then, you know, we will offer help and support. We won't actually kind of go to the public inquiry for people, but we'll advise them on how to go about it. Yes.
I have one specific question as well. One of the things I learned from you was that we own footpaths or the top two.
Yeah.
Spits of it. I have paths locally that I walk on, find very frustrating because the farmers ploughed it or they've grown crops all over it, it's not marked, and therefore people stop using the path. Now, I realise farmers have plenty to deal with, and of course planting crops is what they do, but nonetheless paths can simply disappear. What do we do in that circumstance? Can we do anything?
Oh yes, absolutely. You must do something. I mean, you report any obstructions to the highway authority, and you keep reporting it, but there's also legal action you can take. Mm. And our website has got a lot on this. If it's obstructed, you can take the landowner to court. I mean, obviously, you've got to go through a whole process and be sure of your facts. If the surface is out of repair, you serve a notice on the county council, the unitary council, or you can also serve a notice where the council should have dealt with an obstruction and hasn't, to make the council do something. So there's lots of legal things and you can threaten all that. But don't just live with it. No, you've absolutely got to. And get on with it. Don't let it drift, you know.
So highway authorities first. If people are in trouble, they can come and find information on your website.
Yeah.
And I will post the website link on the post. But just for people now, the website is
oss.org.uk.
Very good. Thank you, Kate. It was very nice to talk to you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that.
Great. Brilliant.
Okay, that's all, folks. Thanks for your indulgence, and remember the Countryside Code and oss.org.uk for more information. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week when we'll return with the Spanish mismatch.